Chapter 54. The dying man opened the permacover notebook, uncapped his pen, paused a moment, and then began to write. It was strange, where once the pen had flown over the paper, seeming to cover each sheet from top to bottom by a process of benign magic. The words now straggled and draggled, the letters large and tottery, as if he was regressing back to early grammar school days in his own private time machine. In those days, his mother and father had still had some love left over for him. Amy had not yet blossomed, and his own future as the amazing Agunquit fat boy and possible homosexual was not yet decided. He could remember sitting at the sun-washed kitchen table, slowly copying one of the Tom Swift books word for word in a blue horse tablet, pulp stock, blue lines, with a glass of Coke beside him. He could hear his mother's words drifting out of the living room. Sometimes she was talking on the phone, sometimes to a neighbor. "It's just baby fat, the doctor says so. There's nothing wrong with his glands, thank God. And he's so bright." Watching the words grow, letter by letter. Watching the sentences grow, word by word. Watching the paragraphs grow, each one a brick in the great walled bulwark that was language. "It's to be my greatest invention," Tom said forcefully. "Watch what happens when I pull out the plate, but for gosh sakes, don't forget to shield your eyes." The bricks of language. A stone, a leaf, an unfound door. Worlds, magic, life and immortality. Power. "I don't know where he gets it, Rita. Maybe from his grandfather. He was an ordained minister, and they say he gave the most wonderful sermons." Watching the letters improve as time passed. Writing now, mere copying left behind. Assembling thoughts and plots. That was the whole world, after all, nothing but thoughts and plots. He had gotten a typewriter, finally, and by then there wasn't much else left over for him. Amy was in high school, National Honor Society, cheerleader, and all the rest, and her brother's baby fad had not yet departed, although he was 13 years old, and had mastered the keys quickly. As he improved, he was at last able to keep up with his racing thoughts and snare them all. But he had never stopped his longhand entirely, remembering that Moby Dick had been written longhand, and The Scarlet Letter, and Paradise Lost. Writing longhand was work, terrible hand-cramping work, but it was a labor of love. He had used the typewriter willingly and gratefully, but thought he had always saved the best of himself for longhand. And now he would transcribe the last of himself that same way. He looked up and saw buzzards circling slowly in the sky, like something from a Saturday matinee movie with Randolph Scott, or from a novel by Max Brand. He thought of it written in a novel. Harold saw the buzzards circling in the sky, waiting. He looked at them calmly for a moment, and then bent to his journal again. He bent to his journal again. He was reminded achingly of the sunny kitchen, the cold glass of Coke, the old and mildewy Tom Swift book. And now, at last, he thought and wrote, he might have been able to make his mother and father happy. He had lost his baby fat, and although still a virgin, he was morally sure that he was not a homosexual. He opened his mouth and croaked, "Top of the world, Ma." He looked at what he had written, then looked at his leg, which was twisted and broken. Broken? That was too kind a word. It was shattered. He had been sitting in the shade of this rock for 5 days now. The last of his food was gone. He would have died of thirst yesterday or the day before, except for 2 hard showers. His leg was putrefying. It had a green and gassy smell, and the flesh had swelled tight against his pants, stretching the khaki fabric till it resembled a sausage casing. Nadine was long gone. Harold picked up the gun that had been lying by his side and checked the loads. He had checked them 100 times or more just this day. During the rainstorms, he had been careful to keep the gun dry. There were 3 cartridges left in it. He had fired the first 2 at Nadine when she looked down and told him she was going on without him. They had been coming around a hairpin turn. Nadine on the inside, Harold on the outside, aboard his Triumph cycle. They were on the Colorado western slope, about 70 miles from the Utah border. There had been an oil slick on the outer part of the curve, and in the days since, Harold had pondered much on this oil slick. It seemed almost too perfect. An oil slick from what? Surely nothing had been moving up here over the last 2 months. Plenty of time for a slick to dry up. It was as if he had been waiting for the correct time to produce an oil slick and take Harold out of the play. Leave him with her, through the mountains, in case of trouble, and then ditch him. He had, as they say, served his purpose. The Triumph had slid into the guardrails, and Harold had been flung over the side like a bug. There had been an excruciating pain in his right leg. He had heard the wet snap as it broke. He screamed. Then hardscrabble coming up to meet him, hardscrabble that was falling away at a steep, sickening angle toward the gorge below. He hit the ground, bounced high into the air, screamed again, came down on his right leg once more, heard it break someplace else, went flying into the air again and came down, rolled, and suddenly fetched up against a dead tree that had healed over in some years-ago thunderstorm. If it hadn't been there, he would have gone into the gorge and the mountain trout could have snacked on him instead of the buzzards. He wrote in his notebook, still marveling at the straggling child-sized letters, "I don't blame Nadine." That was true, but he had blamed her then. Shocked, shaken, scraped raw, his right leg a bolt of agony, he had picked himself up and had crawled a little way up the slope. Far above him, he saw Nadine looking over the guardrail. Her face was white and tiny, a doll's face. "Nadine!" he cried. His voice came out in a hard croak. "The rope! It's in my left saddlebag!" She only looked down at him. He had begun to think she hadn't heard him, and he was prepared to repeat when he saw her head move to the left, to the right, to the left again. Very slowly. She was shaking her head. "Nadine! I can't get up without the rope. My leg's broken." She didn't answer. She was only looking down at him, not even shaking her head. He began to have the feeling he was down in a deep hole, and she was looking at him over the rim of it. "Nadine, for the love of God, toss me the rope." At last her voice drifted down to him, small but perfectly audible in the great mountain stillness. "All of this was arranged, Harold. I have to go on. I'm very sorry." But she made no move to go. She remained at the guardrail, watching him. Already there were flies, busily sampling his blood on the various rocks where he had hit and scraped off some of himself. He began to crawl upward again, dragging his shattered leg behind him. At first there was no hate, no need to put a bullet in her. It only seemed vital that he get close enough to read her expression. Sweat dripped from his face and onto the sharp pebbles and rocks he was climbing over. He moved by dragging himself upward on his elbows and pushing with his left leg like a crippled insect. His breath rasped in and out of his throat, a hot file. He had no idea how long it went on, but once or twice he bumped his bad leg against a stone outcropping, and the giant burst of pain had caused him to gray out. Several times he had slipped backward. At last he became stupidly aware that he could go no further. The shadows had changed. 3 hours had passed. He could not remember the last time he had looked up toward the guardrails and the road. Over an hour ago, surely. In his pain, he had been completely absorbed in whatever minute progress he was making. Nadine had probably left long ago. But she had still been there, and although he had only succeeded in gaining 25 feet or so, the expression on her face was hellishly clear. It was one of grieving sorrow, but her eyes were flat and far away. Her eyes were with him. That was when he began to hate her, and he felt for the shoulder holster. The Colt was still there, held in during his tumbling fall by the strap across the butt. He snapped the strap off.
"Nadine, it's better this way, Harold. Better for you, because his way would be so much worse. You see that, don't you? You wouldn't want to meet him face to face, Harold. He feels that someone who would betray one side would probably betray the other. He'd kill you, but he'd drive you mad first. He has that power. He let me choose, this way or his way. I chose this. You can end it quickly if you're brave. You know what I mean. He checked the loads in the pistol for the first of hundreds, maybe thousands of times, keeping the gun in the shadowed hollow of one lacerated and shredded elbow. "What about you?" he called up. "Aren't you a betrayer, too?" Her voice was sad. "I never betrayed him in my heart." "I believe that's exactly where you did betray him," Harold called up to her. He tried to put a large expression of sincerity on his face, but he was actually calculating the distance. He would have two shots at the most, and a pistol was a notoriously chancy weapon. "And I believe he knows it." "He needs me," she said, "and I need him. You were never in it, Harold. And if we'd gone on together, I might have let you do something to me. That small thing. And that would have destroyed everything. I couldn't take the smallest chance that might happen after all the sacrifice and blood and nastiness. We sold our souls together, Harold, but there's enough of me left to want full value for mine."
"I'll give you full value," Harold said, and managed to get up on his knees.
The sun was dazzling. Vertigo seized him in rough hands, whirling the gyroscope balance inside his head. He seemed to hear voices, a voice, roaring in surprised protest. He pulled the trigger. The shot echoed, bounced back, was thrown from cliff face to cliff face, cracking and whacking and fading. Comical surprise spread over Nadine's face. Harold thought in a drunken kind of triumph, "She didn't think I had it in me." Her mouth hung open in a shocked round O. Her eyes were wide. The fingers of her hands tensed and flew up, as if she were about to play some abnormal tune on the piano. The moment was so sweet that he lost a second or two savoring it and not realizing that he had missed. When he did realize, he brought the pistol back down, trying to aim it, locking his right wrist with his left hand.
"Harold, no, you can't."
"Can't I? It's such a little thing squeezing a trigger. Sure I can." She seemed too shocked to move, and as the pistol's front sight came to rest in the hollow of her throat, he felt a sudden cold certainty that this was how it was meant to end. He had her dead in his sights. But as he started to pull the trigger, sweat ran into his eyes, doubling his vision. He began to slide. He later told himself that the loose gravel had given way, or that his mangled leg had buckled, or both. It might even have been true. But it felt like a push. And in the long nights between then and now, he had not been able to convince himself otherwise. The daytime Harold was stubbornly rational to the end. But in the night, the hideous certainty stole over him that in the end, it had been the dark man himself who had thwarted him. The shot went wild, high, wide, and handsome into the indifferent blue sky. Harold went rolling and tumbling back down to the dead tree, his right leg twisting and buckling, a huge sheet of agony from ankle to groin. He had passed out. When he came to again, it was just past dusk, and the moon, three-quarters full, was riding solemnly over the gorge. Nadine was gone. He spent that first night in a delirium of terror. When morning came, he began to crawl upward again, sweating and racked with pain. He began around 7 o'clock, just about the time the big orange burial crew trucks would be leaving the bus depot back in Boulder. He finally wrapped one raw and blistered hand around the guardrail cable at 5 o'clock that afternoon. His motorcycle was still there, and he nearly wept with relief. He dug some cans and the opener out of one of the saddlebags with frantic haste, opened one of the cans, and crammed cold corned beef hash into his mouth in double handfuls. But it tasted bad, and after a long struggle, he threw it up. He began to understand the irrefutable fact of his coming death then, and he lay beside the Triumph and wept, his twisted leg under him. After that, he was able to sleep a little. The following day, he was drenched by a pounding rain shower that left him soaked and shivering. His leg had begun to smell of gangrene, and he took pains to keep the Colt Woodsman sheltered from the wet with his body. That evening he had begun to write in the permacover notebook and discovered for the first time that his handwriting was beginning to regress. He wrote, Are they all dead, I wonder? The committee? If so, I'm sorry. I was misled. That is a poor excuse for my actions, but I swear out of all I know that it is the only excuse that ever matters. The dark man is as real as the superflu itself, as real as the atomic bombs that still sit somewhere in their lead-lined closets. And when the end comes, and when it is as horrible as good men always knew it would be, there is only one thing to say as all those good men approach the throne of judgment. I was misled. Harold read what he had written and passed a thin and trembling hand over his brow. It wasn't a good excuse, it was a bad one. Pretty it up however you would, it still smelled. Someone who read that paragraph after reading his ledger would see him as a total hypocrite. He had seen himself as the king of anarchy, but the dark man had seen through him and had reduced him effortlessly to a shivering bag of bones, dying badly by the highway. He lay there with buzzards swooping and diving in the thermals overhead, trying to rationalize the unspeakable. He had fallen victim to his own protracted adolescence. It was as simple as that. He had been poisoned by his own lethal visions. Dying, he felt as if he had gained a little sanity, and maybe even a little dignity. He did not want to demean that with small excuses that came limping off the page in crutches. I could have been something in Boulder, he said quietly. And the simple, awful truth of that might have brought tears if he hadn't been so tired and so dehydrated. He looked at the straggling letters on the page, and from there to the colt. Suddenly he wanted it over, and he tried to think how to put a finish to his life in the truest, simplest way he could. It seemed more necessary than ever to write it and leave it for whoever might find him in 1 year or in 10. He gripped the pen, thought, wrote. I apologize for the destructive things I have done, but do not deny that I did them of my own free will. On my school papers, I always signed my name Harold Emery Lauder. I signed my manuscripts in the same way. God help me, I once wrote it on the roof of a barn in letters 3 feet high. I want to sign this by a name given me in Boulder. I could not accept it then, but I take it now freely. I am going to die in my right mind. Writing neatly at the bottom, he affixed his signature, Hawk. He put the permacover notebook into the Triumph's saddlebag. He capped the pen and clipped it in his pocket. He put the muzzle of the colt into his mouth and looked up at the blue sky. He thought of a game they had played when they were children, a game the others had teased him about because he had never quite dared to go through with it. There was a gravel pit out on one of the back roads, and you could jump off the ledge and fall a heart-stopping distance before hitting the sand, rolling over and over, and finally jumping up to do it all over again. All except Harold. Harold would stand on the lip of the drop and chant, 1, 2, 3, just like the others, but the talisman never worked. His legs remained locked. He could not bring himself to jump. And the others sometimes chased him home, shouting at him, calling him Harold the Pansy. He thought, if I could have brought myself to jump, once, just once, I might not be here. Well, last time pays for all. He thought, 1, 2, 3. He pulled the trigger. The gun went off. Harold jumped.